men. I'm going to take this whore upstairs. Whoever wants her next can come and get her when I'm done.
In 1948, President Harry Truman had grown concerned about the structural integrity of the 148-year-old White House. Engineers were brought in to investigate, and they found that the mansion was in danger of collapsing. The less-than-sound renovation of 1902 and the enlargement of the third story in 1927 had weakened the structure severely. It was recommended that the president and his wife vacate the house immediately, and they moved across the street to Blair House to allow a massive 4-year renovation to ensue. The first step was the meticulous disassembly of everything within the White House. All of the furniture, artwork, and fixtures were removed, and with painstaking effort, the floors, ceilings, and walls were dismantled section by section. The mansion became an empty shell while construction crews moved in to excavate 2 new levels beneath the original basement. After the third and second basements had been completed, a modern steel framework was erected to support the mansion's aging walls. The new third basement that had been added in the renovation was designed to house the new boiler room and was only about a quarter the size of the floors above it. Over the last several decades, much of the massive boiler had been replaced by the newer, more efficient systems designed to protect the building from chemical and biological attacks. As Rapp and Adams stood at the boiler room's door, Adams pointed out the most recent change to the White House.
Straight down the hall and to the left is the president's bunker. As you turn the corner, you go down a hall that's about 50 feet long, and then there's a reinforced steel door. Once you're through that door, you're in the room just outside the bunker.
Rapp nodded. We're going up the stairs to the left, away from the bunker, correct?
Correct.
All right. Let's take one last look at this thing, and then we'll move out. Adams manipulated the lens until Rapp was satisfied that the door had not been booby-trapped and the cable was withdrawn. With his gun ready, Rapp slowly opened the door and stepped out into the hallway. They moved to the left and into the concrete stairwell that ascended one flight to the second basement. Adams stuck the tiny lens under the next metal door and found nothing. With Rapp and his MP10 in the lead, they continued to the first basement landing and stopped. Adams checked under this door as well, and Rapp became increasingly suspicious that they had come this far and found nothing. He thought the disease would have set up some type of an early warning system. Whispering in Rapp's ear, Adams said,
"No booby traps."
Rapp looked at the screen while Adams moved the tiny lens back and forth and asked,
"What about the hallway?"
After moving the snake around a little, Adams gave Rapp a clear shot of the hall.
"Midway down, right-hand side. That's our door."
"Good," Rapp whispered back. "Secure that thing. And when I give you the signal, open the door and follow me. Stay on my right and one step back, no matter what happens."
Adams closed the screen against his chest, zipped it up, and then coiled the snake into a loose loop and strapped it to his hip. Rapp gripped his MP10 tightly in both hands, the collapsible stock wedged between his cheek and shoulder. With the thick black silencer leveled at the closed door, Rapp nodded. Adams jerked the door open, and Rapp took one step forward, sweeping the gun from left to right. He walked quickly forward, and Adams followed closely behind. The metal fire door closed automatically behind them. Both men walked softly, making almost no noise. Rapp spun several times, nervously checking their six, looking for any sign of a motion sensor or tripwire. A third of the way down the hall, Adams stopped at another gray metal door, extracted his S key, and opened the door to reveal a hidden elevator. Rapp swore under his breath while they waited for the elevator to arrive, exposed in the middle of the hallway. When the doors finally opened, Adams silently shooed Rapp into the tiny compartment and pressed the proper button. The elevator was big enough to handle 4 people at the most. As the elevator started to move, Rapp handed his gun to Adams, and with both hands he took his headset from around his neck and secured it over his baseball cap. Static crackled loudly from his earpiece, but as they rose it lessened. The elevator ascended quickly and noiselessly. By the time they reached the second floor, the static was greatly decreased, and Rapp had his weapon back in his hands. When the elevator stopped, Adams gave Rapp an uneasy look. Rapp nodded and said, "Don't worry." And with a grin to help ease the tension, he added, "I'll go first." Then, pulling his lip mic down, he whispered, "Iron Man to command. Over." Rapp waited several seconds for a reply and then repeated his words. After the third check, he thought he heard something, but it was too broken up to discern. They would have to move to the stash room and set up a more powerful secure field radio. Rapp looked up at the small light above his head. It would have to be extinguished before they opened the door. After popping the frosted glass cover off the fixture, he reached up and gave the hot bulb several quick turns with his bare hand. The bulb flickered and then went dark. Rapp then pulled a circular red plastic filter from one of his pockets and attached it to the flashlight that was affixed to the barrel of his submachine gun. When he turned on the flashlight, a faint red light illuminated the floor of the elevator. Adams pressed a button, and the elevator doors opened to reveal a wall. There was no crack to wedge the snake under, so they would have to chance it and go forward without looking. Slowly, Adams ran his hand along the wall until he found what he was looking for. As Adams pressed the catch, the wall popped outward several inches, revealing the tile floor of the president's bathroom. The lights were off, and the room was dark, with the exception of the faint red light coming from under the barrel of Rapp's gun. Rapp checked the way and slid through the narrow entrance, taking three cautious steps toward the bedroom. Milt followed close behind. The door was open. Rapp checked for tripwires and then looked into the actual bedroom. The door that led to the hallway was slightly open, and a sliver of light spilled into the dark room from the hallway. Before entering the bedroom, Rapp looked back over his shoulder and whispered, "Close that." Placing both hands on the wall, Adams pushed it back into place. The wall shut with a slight click, and all traces of the hidden elevator disappeared. Rapp stepped cautiously into the room. He moved across the president's bedroom to the door that led to the Truman balcony, the semicircular porch that overlooked the south lawn. When Rapp reached the door, he froze in his tracks. He had missed it on the first sweep, but caught the slightest glimpse of it on the second. A thin, clear wire ran across the base of the door about 12 inches off the ground. Rapp's right hand snapped up next to his head in a tight-closed fist. Milt Adams, a combat veteran, knew the hand signal all too well and froze in his tracks. At first, only Rapp's eyes moved, and then his head swiveled from side to side. Adams was good enough to not say anything. It was apparent from Rapp's body language that he had found something. What Rapp had found was a filament trip wire, and he knew it was attached to something that petrified him. Rapp hated bombs. One of the qualities that made him so successful during his almost decade of service with the CIA was knowing his own limitations. He didn't have the patience or the skill to deal with explosives, so he tended to avoid them like the plague. The problem with bombs was there were 100 different ways to set them off, and a dozen of them could happen before you ever got within a foot of the actual device. There could be a pressure pad under the carpet, a magnetic plate, infrared beams, microwave beams, motion sensors, tremble or mercury switches. The list went on and on. And with Rafik Aziz involved, Rapp had no doubt these devices would be really hairy. One thing was certain, however. The tripwire was attached to something, and Rapp had to find out exactly what it was. The door leading to the balcony was bordered on both sides with drapes. Rapp stepped carefully to his right and looked behind a chair situated between the door and a window to the right. Sticking the black silencer of his gun behind the curtain, he pointed it down and found nothing on this side of the door, but on the left side, he could discern the rectangular shape of a box. The tripwire was attached to a switch on the side of the bomb and a nail on the other side of the door. Rapp crossed over to the other side of the door and examined the box from a closer angle. It appeared that the tripwire was the only exterior trigger device. Rapp wiped a bead of sweat from his brow, and then reluctantly, he drew back the curtain. The box was simple, about 8 inches high and 6 wide. In the upper right corner was a small red digital readout and a green light that blinked every 3 seconds. Gingerly, he let the drape fall back into its natural hanging position and took a step back. If the box was loaded with Semtex, the Czechoslovakian version of C4 Plastique, there was probably enough to blow the entire wall halfway across the south lawn. Milt Adams leaned over and whispered, "What did you find?"
"A bomb."
Rapp wiped some more sweat from his face.
"If we set one of these things off, they'll be picking us up with a vacuum cleaner, Milt. Let's leave this alone and get ourselves set up."
Adams led the way across the bedroom to a large walk-in closet. Rapp followed him in and left the door open as they had found it. On the left was a substantial closet organizer. The smaller compartments near the bottom were filled with pairs of shoes, but as the organizer rose, the cubicles grew larger and were occupied by shirts and sweaters. Near the far corner, Adams stopped and reached up along the edge. After feeling around for a second, he found what he was looking for and pressed the obscured button. The organizer popped outward several inches at one end, and then Adams swung it open 3 more feet. They entered the hidden room and pulled the organizer shut behind them. Adams turned on the wall light and slid a heavy steel bolt across the doorway. The small room, referred to as the stash room by the Secret Service, was 8 feet long by 6 feet wide, and the ceiling was almost 10 feet high. The walls were lined with bulletproof Kevlar and fire-retardant cloth on both the exterior and interior walls. The room also contained 4 biohazard suits complete with oxygen tanks and gas masks. These were packed in storage lockers that were bolted to the walls above their heads, along with some weapons and a first aid kit. The room was built in response to a small plane crashing into the south portico in the fall of 1994. The technicians in the first row of the control room at Langley had faintly heard Rapp's original signal. They had been working diligently for 5 minutes to clear up the link as Irene Kennedy and General Campbell watched from one row back. The two knew enough to let their people work and stay out of their way. With the help of Marcus Dumond, who was manning the control panel of the CIA's communications van parked outside the White House fence, they were making progress. The telescoping boom on the back of the van was helping penetrate the electronic interference the terrorists were using. When Rapp began to transmit on the powerful, secure field radio, there was a collective sigh of relief in the control room as 40-plus minutes of tense radio silence came to an end. General Campbell was the first to speak.
"Give me a sit-rep, Iron Man."
Rapp's reply came back slightly garbled but audible. He recounted how the insertion had progressed and the device he had discovered in the president's bedroom. After Rapp had given as much detail as possible about the explosive device, he asked Campbell and Kennedy what they wanted him to do. Campbell thought about it for only a second and replied,
"Continue your reconnaissance, and we'll figure out what to do about the bomb."
"Roger that," replied Rapp. "I'll get to work."
Back in the control room at Langley, one of the technicians in the front row raised his hand up and snapped his fingers. Kennedy leaned forward and listened to what the technician had to say, then spoke into her headset.
"Iron Man, we need you to conduct a radio check on your portable. Over."
Rapp was holding the handset to the secure field radio to his ear and replied, "Roger."
He put his headset back on and adjusted the lip mic.
"Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Do you read? Over."
They could hear Rapp well enough to understand what he was saying, but not as clearly as when he used the field radio. The larger problem was that Rapp was having a hard time receiving signals. After several tries, Rapp lifted the lip mic of his headset and picked up the handset to the field radio.
"My radio isn't working. Over."
"We can hear you on our end, Iron Man," replied Kennedy. "Are you saying you can't receive us?"
"That's correct."
Kennedy looked to one of the technicians to see if there were any answers. All she got was an unknowing shrug. Into her headset, she said,
"Iron Man, we'll work on that. For now, why don't you check out the rest of the second floor, and then check in on the field radio in 30 minutes?
Roger that. I'll start to set up the surveillance cameras. Over and out.
Rapp placed the handset back in its cradle and started to organize his gear. Taking the fanny pack of miniature surveillance units, Rapp extracted 5 of the devices and placed them in his web vest.
Staircases first? Asked Adams.
Yep.
Rapp grabbed his gun. Just like before, Milt. Keep your eyes peeled and don't walk anywhere where I haven't walked first, all right?
Adams nodded. Any questions before we get going?
Yeah. Adams looked slightly embarrassed. I gotta take a piss.
Rapp grinned, appreciating the much-needed levity.
We can take care of that. In fact, we'll make it our first stop. All right, let's move out.
Adams pulled the bolt back, and he and Rapp quietly walked out into the large closet. Adams pushed the bookcase-like organizer back into place, and it stopped with a soft click. With his gun at the ready, Rapp stood outside the bathroom while Adams went in and took care of business. Rapp took the time to look around the room and noticed something he had missed earlier. Something odd. The president's bed was in disarray. Rapp walked over to the bed, and on closer examination he saw something startling, something that made his blood boil. There was a substantial splotch of blood on the white sheets, and dangling off the side of the bed was a woman's bra. Rapp shook his head in disgust at the scene. When Adams came out of the bathroom a moment later, Rapp pointed at the disturbing evidence. Neither man said a word. After a long moment, Rapp walked across the room to a small end table situated near the door that led to the Truman balcony. Taking one of the small surveillance units from his pocket, he attached one of the Velcro patches to the underside of the table and secured the tiny device. Rapp motioned to Adams. Let's go. He moved for the main door and stopped when he reached it. Adams stuck the tiny black snake under the door and checked the hallway. The lights were on, and the picture was very clear. The cross hall on the second floor of the family residence was wide, about 15 feet. It was brightly lit, and the walls were adorned with built-in bookcases and several oil portraits of past presidents. Various groupings of couches, chairs, tables, and lamps gave the space the dual role of informal living room and hallway. Adams manipulated the snake back and forth and whispered,
"It looks clear."
Rapp nodded and said, "Let me take a look first, and then I'll wave you out." Rapp looked at the camera one more time and checked the hallway. Slowly, Rapp turned the knob and opened the door, taking the first step into the brightly lit hallway. Chapter 24. Her eyes blinked several times before they could stay open. Anna Reilly let out a weak groan. It took her a second to regain her senses, and even then she had no idea where she was. All she knew was her head ached and she was having a hard time breathing. As her eyes came into focus, she saw stairs and then a pair of legs and boots. For a second, she thought she was dreaming, and then everything fell into place. The terrorist was carrying her over his shoulder. She tried to lift her head, but a searing pain shot through her neck. She knew she had to fight no matter how much it hurt. Reilly commanded herself to ignore the pain, and with as much strength as she could muster, the young journalist bolted upright and grabbed onto the slicked back hair of the man who was carrying her. Reilly kicked her feet violently and began to scream at the top of her lungs. Mitch Rapp almost jumped out of his skin. The female voice was so loud and so sudden that it caught him completely off guard. He was standing exposed in the middle of the hallway, bathed in light. The violent scream had shattered the stillness and sent his nerves right to the edge. Rapp paused just long enough to ascertain which direction the scream was coming from, and then immediately began to move while Milt Adams stood frozen 2 steps behind. Like a big cat, Rapp began a rapid retreat. Instinctively, his right hand reached back in search of Adams. His left hand kept the lethal barrel of his MP-10 aimed in the direction of the scream, and he pushed Adams back into the open doorway of the president's bedroom. With Adams now in the lead, they hurried into the closet, and Rapp closed the door behind them. Adams had the door to the stash room open and paused for a second to see what Rapp wanted to do. Rapp pushed him into the small room and pulled the organizer closed behind them. Adams turned on the light and grabbed his heart.
Jesus, how do you do this shit for a living?
Rapp, his own adrenaline pumping, grabbed the monitor around Milt's neck and tuned the picture to the tiny surveillance device they had just planted less than 20 feet away. Anna Reilly clutched her stomach with one hand and the wrist of the terrorist with the other. Her shoes had fallen off, and she could see them halfway down the hallway as the thug dragged her across the carpet. Tears streamed down her cheeks, and the pain from the kick to her stomach was so intense she thought she might vomit. Abu Hassan liked the fight. He considered it part of the thrill, part of the domination. This one, the dark one, was much better than the one he had taken care of last night. The blonde had turned out to be boring. There was no fight in her, only tears. Hassan smiled widely as he rounded the corner and saw the door to the president's bedroom. It was the perfect place to rape this American whore. Hassan thrust open the door with one hand while he held on to Reilly's ponytail with the other. After dragging her another 10 feet, he violently lifted her off the ground and threw her onto the king-size bed. Drawing his knife, he yelled at her,
"Take your clothes off, you bitch!"
Reilly started to get back up. There was no way she was going to give in. She would rather die than be raped again. The terrorist blocked her arms and sent the butt end of the knife crashing down and into Reilly's temple. The blow knocked her unconscious, and Reilly went limp, leaving her completely motionless and vulnerable on the bed. Abu Hassan wasted no time. Taking his knife, he began cutting off her clothes. The more skin he revealed, the faster he cut. Once he had her pants off, he ripped at her blouse and then stopped for a second. Lustfully, he looked down at the young woman before him and admired her tanned, firm body. Slowly, he reached down and ran his hand over her leg. He stopped at her black lace panties, and then with a violent yank, he tore them from her body. Milt Adams was disturbed by what was happening in the other room, but it wasn't as scary as the transformation taking place right in front of him. Mitch Rapp's face had taken on a very different look. His eyes had twisted into a menacing stare, his jaw was clenched, and a sheen of sweat now coated his forehead. Rapp shook his head several times and muttered something through his clenched teeth. Inside his mind, a battle was being waged. The logical side was telling him that the mission was more important than what was going on in the other room. All of his professional training had taught him that he should stay put and continue to collect information without announcing his presence, that the lives of the other hostages were more important, that killing Rafiq Aziz was more important. Despite knowing what he should do, there was another voice in his head that was saying something entirely different. Back in the control room at Langley, all eyes were on the big board. A surveillance device had been activated by Rapp, and its grainy transmission was being received on one of the monitors. The technicians at Langley worked with Marcus Dumont, who, with the aid of the communications boom on the back of the van, was homing in on the frequency and trying to filter out the disturbances. Over the course of several minutes, the picture began to clear, eventually revealing a lone man in a lit doorway. Without taking his eyes off the screen, General Campbell asked Kennedy,
"Is that the president's bedroom?"
"It must be," replied Kennedy, as she squinted at the monitor. She watched as the man in the doorway turned and walked quickly back into the room. A second man's profile appeared in the doorway, and Kennedy immediately recognized it as Rapp's.
"Why are they going back into the closet?" asked Campbell.
Kennedy frowned. "I don't know." One of the technicians turned around and said,
"We've got audio on the unit."
"Put it on the speaker system," stated Kennedy. without taking her eyes off the monitor. A second later, a scratchy audio came over the room's overhead speaker system. There was a loud noise, and General Flood, who was sitting one row behind Kennedy and Campbell, asked,
"What in the hell was that?"
Kennedy stared at the monitor showing the open doorway of the president's bedroom with the lit hallway beyond and said, "It sounded like a scream." Just then, a man appeared in the doorway dragging a woman behind him. As if on cue, everyone in the control room moved closer to the screen in an attempt to discern what was happening. Within seconds, it was brutally apparent what was unfolding before them. Kennedy, in an unusually tense voice, snapped,
"Get me Iron Man on the radio right now!"
Kennedy knew Rapp better than anyone in the room, and possibly better than anyone in the world. Kennedy knew she had to assert some control over him, and assert it quickly, if she had even the slightest chance of stopping him from doing what she knew he was contemplating. The MP-10 was on the ground in the corner and had been replaced by the silenced 9mm Beretta. Rapp stared at the gun. Angry beyond comprehension, he felt like punching a hole in the wall. He told himself to bring it back a notch. Too much anger led to poor judgment. But Rapp hated thugs, people that took from others, animals that did what they wanted to do with little or no thought of what their actions did to fellow human beings. Mentally, Rapp was gone. The decision had been made. There was no turning back. The woman in the other room was somebody's daughter, probably somebody's wife, and maybe some poor kid's mother, and there was no way he could allow himself to sit in the safety of the bulletproof room and let it happen. The secure field radio spurted a quiet beeping noise, and a green light on the panel began to flash. Adams reached for the handset, and Rapp stopped him. "Don't answer that." Adams slowly withdrew his hand. He no longer recognized the man sitting next to him. Rapp reached out, turned the power switch on the radio to the off position, and pulled his headset down around his neck. Standing, he retrieved his matte black combat knife and held it in his left hand. He looked at the pistol in one hand and the knife in the other and paused. Standing, Milt Adams licked his dry lips, and with a worried expression on his face, he asked,
"What are you going to do?"
Rapp looked sideways at him, and after a short pause said,
"I'm going to go out there and kill that piece of shit. It's not what I should do, but it's what I'm gonna do."
Adams swallowed hard and with a nod said,
"Good."
Then after a second he added,
"Do you want me to help?"
Rapp shook his head and closed his eyes.
"No. Turn off the lights and open the door. Then stay here and be quiet."
Adams did as he was told. He couldn't see Rapp, but could feel him as Rapp slid through the passageway and into the closet. Anna Reilly opened her eyes and tried to focus. Above her was darkness, but to her right there was light. Slowly she turned her head and saw her attacker. The man had already taken off his shirt and was working on his pants. Reilly tried to move, but her arms wouldn't respond. Looking down, she saw her bare chest through tear-filled eyes. She was living the nightmare. Mitch Rapp stood at the closet doorway for several seconds and listened. His eyes were closed. He wanted them to adjust to the darkness as much as possible. There was a noise from the bedroom. It sounded as if the woman was crying, and then he heard a male laugh. Rapp opened his eyes and looked at his two weapons. He could shoot equally well with either hand, but he was better with the knife in his left hand. Rapp decided that if he could get close enough, he would use the knife, and he had few doubts he could. Before leaving, he started the timer on his watch and then reached for the door. Slowly, cautiously, he turned the handle and began to open it. Reilly sobbed as she looked at the man looming over her. He was laughing, his disgusting cigarette breath enveloping her face. He held his erection with one hand and reached out with his other hand, pawing at Reilly's groin. The young journalist clamped down with her legs and screamed. The terrorist yanked her legs apart and slapped her across the face. Reilly tried to fight, but her strength was gone. All she could do was cry as he lowered his body on top of her. The door opened slowly. Rapp peered through the crack and saw the light from the hallway spilling into the room. From his angle, he could see a man with his back to him taking off his clothes and standing at the foot of the large bed. The man began to climb onto the bed. Now was the time to move. With his knife in his left hand and the gun in his right, Rapp proceeded slowly. He took his first step and then quickly looked to the left and the right to make sure no one else was in the room. He stepped silently, without vibration or noise, carefully placing his heel and then the rest of his foot on the floor. Halfway across the room, Rapp slid his gun back into his holster. The terrorist was holding the woman's hands above her head and was trying to enter her, the woman's sobs muffled by the man's body. Rapp moved quickly to the bed, his right hand open and stretched outward, the left tightly clutching his knife. With fluid precision, he grabbed the hair of the terrorist with his right hand and yanked the man's head back. With his left hand, Rapp stuck the tip of the knife directly into the man's neck and thrust it upward. The sharp knife sliced through muscle and penetrated deep into the base of the brain. With a forceful twist of the knife, Rapp shredded the fragile brainstem. Abu Hassan never knew what happened in his final second on Earth. Still holding the man's hair, Rapp pulled him off the woman and dropped his lifeless body on the floor with as little noise as possible. He placed the bloody knife back in its scabbard, and Rapp held out his hands to the naked woman on the bed.
"Don't scream. We need to move quickly."
The woman looked up with shocked eyes and tried to cover her exposed breasts with her arms. Rapp reached down, untucked the sheet that she was lying on top of, and gently folded it over her body. He knew he had to move fast. There was no telling when someone else might come along. Looking the woman in the eye, he said,
"Listen, I have to move you. I'm going to pick you up and bring you someplace where you'll be safe."
Rapp placed one knee on the bed and really flinched like a scared and beaten dog. Moving slowly, he said,
"More of them could come at any minute. I need to get you out of here."
After giving her several seconds to think about the alternative, Rapp placed one hand under her legs and the other under her upper back. Cradling her to his chest, he stood and whispered,
"Everything's going to be all right."
Rapp walked quickly across the room and into the closet. In a voice just above a whisper, he said,
"Milt, turn the light on."
Almost instantly, the light inside the stash room came on and the hidden door opened wider. Rapp moved the woman inside and placed her on the floor. Then, grabbing his backpack, he opened it and extracted a small kit. Handing it to Adams, he said,
"Give her some water and a couple of these."
Rapp pulled out a packet of Tylenol 3.
"I have to get back out there and try to figure out what to do with that body."
Raghib Kassar looked out across the mass of huddled hostages and checked his watch. It was nearing midnight, and his turn was approaching. There were two other terrorists in the room, and Raghib looked at the one closest to him. The man nodded, signaling for Raghib to go ahead. They were all eagerly awaiting their turn, and the sooner Raghib was done with the woman, the sooner the other two would have their chance. Raghib grinned and flashed his open hand to his compatriot 3 times, telling him to give him 15 minutes. With excitement, he strode from the room, his pace picking up as soon as the door behind him closed. Rapp closed the main door to the bedroom and studied the body for a second. It was no good trying to hide it. Aziz would know his man was missing and would immediately deduce that he had been killed. There had to be another way. Rapp grew impatient as he stood over the dead terrorist, racking his brain for a way out of the mess. After searching the dead man's discarded clothes for information, it came to him. Rapp grabbed the terrorist's knife from the pile of clothes, and he hoisted the body back onto the bed, laying the dead man on his stomach. With the terrorist's own knife, Rapp stabbed him 3 times in the upper back.
Rapp was careful not to use all of his strength, only sending an inch or two of the knife into the flesh. After pausing for a second, Rapp flipped the dead man over and stabbed him 3 times in the chest and 2 times in the neck. Blood was beginning to flow freely over the white sheets. For the finishing touch, he sliced the man's forearms and hands to make it look as if he had tried to block the blows. Rapp took several steps back and looked at the body. He checked the area in front of him and around his feet to make sure none of the blood had gotten on his boots, and then he pulled the body off the bed and onto the floor again. With the bedspread already disheveled and blood all over the sheets, it just might work. Raghib bounded up the last step and looked down the long hallway. He knew the president's bedroom was on the left. He had visited it last night. Raghib smiled to himself when he thought of the fun he'd had with the blonde. She wasn't much of a fighter, but this one would be different. She had already shown some tenacity. Raghib just hoped that she wouldn't be beaten to a bloody pulp by the time he got there. He was a little early, and with any luck he would be able to hear Abu Hassan's moans of ecstasy. The bearded terrorist walked down the hallway, his AK-74 at his side, and a look of anticipation on his face. Rapp grabbed the pile of clothes and began to go through them again. In the combat vest, he found a radio and held it up to his ear. There was no traffic at the moment. He was tempted to take it, but that would tip Aziz off. If the radio was gone, they would change frequencies, and they would also begin to wonder if the woman had acted alone. Rapp studied the device. It was made by a French company he knew little about. He placed the radio back where he'd found it and checked his watch. 4 minutes and 23 seconds had passed. Rapp was standing over the body when he felt an almost indiscernible tremor. Someone was coming down the hall. He drew his gun and bounded across the room to the closet. Just as he closed the closet door, he saw the main door to the bedroom begin to open. Rapp stood at the door for only a second and then cautiously retreated into the stash room, closing and bolting the door behind him. Back in the control room at Langley, Irene Kennedy had given up trying to raise Rapp on the radio. Instead, she sat with everyone else in total silence and watched the events unfold. No one spoke. They all watched, riveted by the real-life drama unfolding on the one small monitor. At first, no one knew what Rapp was doing when he began to stab the man who already lay dead on the floor. Then people began to catch on. General Flood turned to Stansfield and said, "Damn, that kid thinks on his feet." Before Stansfield could reply, Rapp had bolted across the room and into the closet. Almost simultaneously, the bedroom door was opened, and a man in green combat fatigue stood silhouetted by the hallway light. Everyone watched as the man walked across the room and suddenly snapped up his gun from his side, spinning 360 degrees. Next, the lights came on, and then a series of excited calls over the radio. Chapter 25. Washington, D.C. was a city, a federal district, and most notably, the capital of the United States of America. The originally square geographic area was located at the confluence of the Potomac and Anacostia Rivers and was bordered by Maryland on 3 sides and Virginia to the southwest. Founded in 1790 and originally called the Federal City and District of Columbia, after Christopher Columbus, the city was later renamed by Congress for the nation's first president. Because the city's 4 corners pointed in the 4 directions of the compass, it was conveniently split up into quadrants. The southeast quadrant was by far the most economically deprived. The heart of the area was the neighborhood of Anacostia. This violent portion of Washington accounted for more than half of the city's annual murders and was literally a war zone in the shadow of the nation's capital. On the top floor of a rat-infested tenement building in the heart of Anacostia, a man with bleached white hair and a fresh set of tattoos worked diligently as the clock approached midnight.
The building was largely deserted, except for some drug addicts who used the lower floors to trade sex, stolen property, and sometimes even cash for their mood-altering chemical of choice. The building had been chosen by the group because the police rarely patrolled the area out of fear for their own safety. In the grungy apartment on the fifth floor, the windows had been covered with 3/4-inch plywood. The sturdy boards bolted into the window frames, making them impossible to kick in. The door had also been reinforced with 2x4s and plywood, and a series of new locks had been installed. Inside the room, 2 motion sensors, mounted in opposite corners, had ensured the room's integrity for almost 2 weeks. Rafiq Aziz had ordered the white-haired man sitting on the folding chair to find the safe house almost 5 months ago, but Aziz had been adamant about waiting until the last possible moment to set it up. They did not want to attract too much attention. The man sitting in the dirty apartment was Salim Roussan, the same man who, for the last 6 months, had been an inconspicuous bellman at the Washington Hotel, the same man who had taken aim with his SVD sniper rifle at the Secret Service just yesterday. Roussan was no longer an inconspicuous individual. Thanks to the FBI, his employee photo from the hotel had been splashed all over television and every newspaper in the country. That was why Roussan had not seen daylight since walking into this apartment the morning before last. It had all been predicted by Aziz. The group's leader had been explicit about every detail before the raid on the White House, and that is why he had given Roussan only 2 10-round magazines. Aziz had other plans for Roussan, and he wanted him far away from the White House when the police and the FBI showed up. After Roussan had fired all 20 of his rounds, he had left the Soviet-made sniping rifle right there on the balcony overlooking the White House and fled the building by a staircase. When he made it to the street, he proceeded 2 blocks to the Metro Center stop at 12th and F Street and caught the first southbound train. 10 minutes later, he was walking through the slums of Anacostia, his hotel uniform replaced with a Chicago Bulls hat and a leather jacket. Everything had been waiting for Roussan when he arrived. The copious amount of rat droppings and cobwebs had been cleaned up, and the apartment was stocked with everything he needed. Most of the supplies had been bought at the REI store in Bailey's Crossroads, Virginia. It was paid for in cash. The recreational equipment included a cot, a sleeping bag, several folding chairs, 2 tables, and some cooking equipment, all of it designed for campers. A battery-powered generator purred in the corner and provided juice for a small TV, a radio, a police scanner, and several lights. 2 red Coleman coolers contained enough food and water to last him at least 5 days, but he doubted he would use all of it. Tomorrow morning he would venture back out into public and sow the seeds for a special surprise. Roussan looked at his watch and then the cot. He had done everything Aziz had told him to do. He had shaved off his entire beard with the exception of his mustache and goatee. With a pair of clippers, he had buzzed his hair to within a 1/2 inch of his scalp and then bleached it until it was white. Next came the bleaching of the facial hair and eyebrows, and then the pierced right ear. That was the most difficult part, working backward in the mirror and then trying to stop the blood after he had shoved the needle through the earlobe. The finishing touch was a series of fake tattoos. The most conspicuous, an upside-down pink triangle on his right biceps with the words Queer Nation emblazoned underneath. Roussan was not completely comfortable with the disguise. He hated homosexuals, but it had not been his idea. It was Aziz's, and when Aziz gave an order, it was best to follow it. Roussan had 1 task to perform before he left the apartment in the morning. Looking at his watch, he debated whether he should take care of it now or get some sleep first. As he fingered the blocks of explosive Semtex and the box of detonators sitting on the other side of the table, he decided to wait until morning. He would sleep better knowing the bombs were unarmed. Rafiq Aziz and Muammar Benghazi walked up the main staircase of the mansion. Aziz was furious.
They had been lucky enough to take the White House without losing a single man, and now, when he was within 24 hours of achieving his ultimate goal, he had lost a valuable man due to outright stupidity. Momentum was something that Aziz was acutely aware of. The battlefields of history are littered with the corpses of soldiers whose commanders failed to notice the crucial role it plays in every conflict. Benghazi walked a half step behind, ashamed that one of his men had been foolish enough to get killed by a woman. When they reached the second floor of the mansion, Aziz and Benghazi proceeded directly across the hall and into the president's bedroom. Every light in the room was on. Aziz walked to the other side of the bed and looked down at the bloody, naked body. Raghib, the man who had found his slain comrade, was standing on the other side of the body, his radio in one hand and his assault rifle in the other. He started to speak, but Aziz raised his hand and silenced him. The leader of the group said nothing for a long while as his eyes took inventory of the scene. After several minutes, Aziz looked up. The expression on his face was one of controlled anger. In a curt tone, he asked, "What in the hell happened?" Raghib nervously began to recount the events, content that for now Aziz hadn't executed him. Raghib told him how Abu Hassan had knocked the woman out and dragged her from the room. He gave his leader the details of what he had found and what little he knew about the woman. When Raghib was done, Aziz looked at the body for a second and then at the nervous man standing before him. No bad deed was to go unpunished. Examples had to be made. Fear had to be maintained. With no warning whatsoever, Aziz brought his hand up and slapped Raghib across the face. Raghib held his ground, offering his chin for another blow. Although he was stronger and bigger than Aziz, he feared his leader deeply. Fighting back or blocking the blow was not a consideration. Taking the muzzle of his MP5, Aziz shoved it under Raghib's chin and backed him up until he was pinned against the wall.
"Give me one good reason why I shouldn't kill you for your stupidity."
"I have no excuse."
Raghib kept his voice calm, knowing that any sign of fear or disrespect could end his life instantly.
"I deserve to die. I was stupid."
Mitch had made it into the room with seconds to spare. Milt Adams knelt in the corner next to the woman Rapp had just saved and tried to keep her calm. The battered woman had been shaking for the better part of 5 minutes, and Adams was beginning to worry that she might be slipping into some type of shock. Rapp tried his best to ignore Adams and the woman and stay focused on what the people back at Langley were saying. He had already received his reprimand for not seeking the approval of the High Command before saving the woman. Rapp liked to use the phrase, High Command, to describe anyone who sat comfortably in a dark room that was dimly lit with computer and TV screens and gave orders to operators in the field. On this particular mission, he respected the people who were giving orders. Kennedy was someone whom he trusted implicitly, and Campbell, Flood, and Stansfield had all been in the field before, something that went a long way. Rapp, however, had a new axiom in life. The stubborn half-German had just recently figured out that instead of fighting the system, it was often better to say yes and then go off and do whatever you thought was best. Washington was a bureaucratic monolith that more often than not moved with the speed and agility of a 500-pound man. Like most clandestine operators, Rapp saw Washington's role as a secondary one. And because of this, he had developed the habit of being very cautious about what information he passed on while in the field. Rapp had discovered that the less they thought he was doing, the more support they seemed to give him, while inversely, the more he told them, especially bad news, the less support he seemed to get. Kennedy almost always went to bat for him, but there were others in Washington who had built their careers on doing nothing. Rapp sat on his heels, his eyes trained on the monitor, his left ear receiving the audio from the president's bedroom and his right ear receiving the audio from Langley. The only voices coming from Langley were those of Kennedy, Campbell, Stansfield, and Flood.
None of them had bothered to criticize him for saving the woman. They all knew or hoped they would have done the same thing. General Flood had, however, stressed that from this point forward there was a chain of command firmly in place, and it was to be used. Using his new axiom, Rapp replied with a simple, "Yes, sir." For the next several tense minutes, the group discussed how to proceed, but before long there was no need to speculate. The entrance of two men into the bedroom silenced all radio chatter. Rapp squinted at the small monitor and instantly recognized the body language of the smaller man. The hair on Rapp's neck stood on end and his palms became moist. When Rapp heard the voice of this man, his heart began to race almost out of control. Instinctively, Rapp found himself reaching for his MP10. The desire to kill seemed to possess him. Rafik Aziz was on the other side of the wall, probably no more than 10 feet away, and his back was to the door. As Rapp rose to one knee, the voice of Irene Kennedy came over the handset.
"Iron Man, I know what you're thinking, and it's not going to happen. The odds aren't right. There are three of them and one of you."
Rapp paused, tempted not to reply. Unfortunately, he had already tried that once, and it wasn't going to work twice. Rapp exhaled and said, "I can take them down and end this right now," his voice a little edgy. Kennedy's even voice came right back.
"Or you could get killed and ruin our only chance for finding out what's going on in there."
"I won't get killed," answered Rapp in a tense voice. "At least not before I take all three of them down first." Back at Langley, Kennedy spun around in her chair and looked up at Director Stansfield. She shook her head vigorously at her boss. Stansfield, for his part, sat calmly in his chair with one arm folded across his chest and the hand of the other one under his chin. Touching the arm of his headset, he said,
"Iron Man, hold for a second while we discuss our options."
Stansfield pressed a button on his console and leaned forward. General Flood scooted his chair over several feet, and Kennedy and General Campbell placed their hands on the long table that ran in front of the elevated row. Kennedy was the first to speak.
"I don't like the odds."
Stansfield looked from Kennedy to Campbell, and the general replied,
"I don't know. I'm tempted. We've had a bullseye on this guy's head for a long time, and Mitch is awfully good."
Stansfield turned to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Flood rubbed the knob of his chin with his hand. Frowning, he answered,
"We're not even an hour into this operation, and we have 60-plus hostages on the line. I think we wait."
With a shake of the head, Flood added, "If he doesn't get all three of them, we're in deep shit." All of them turned and looked at the monitor showing the three terrorists. One of them turned and walked closer to the door. Stansfield shook his head and punched the button on his console. Adjusting the lip mic of his headset, he said,
"Iron Man, you are to hold your position. I repeat, you are to hold your position."
Back in the stash room, Rapp squeezed the tough plastic handset so tightly his knuckles turned white. In his mind, he was swearing the same four-letter word over and over while kicking himself for answering Kennedy's call. He should have put a bullet in the field radio and gone out and ended it. Thinking he still had a chance, Rapp stated, "I respectfully disagree. I have three targets, all standing within 15 feet of each other." Rapp looked at the monitor. "They have their backs to my position, and I have the element of surprise on my side. This is not a difficult takedown." This time it was General Flood's voice that came back over the radio.
"Iron Man, you are not to move, and that is an order. We need your eyes and ears in there, and we have time on our side."
Flood's voice boomed with authority. In a slightly softer tone, he added,
"You'll get your chance, son. Just be patient."
Reluctantly, Rapp replied, "Roger that." Then, taking the handset, he tapped the ear portion against his forehead repeatedly. "Next time," he told himself, "just do it. Don't bother asking." Rafik Aziz still had the muzzle of his MP5 stuck firmly under the chin of Raghib. If he'd had more men at his disposal, Raghib would be dead, but he needed every last body.
That was why Aziz had brought so many explosives. It was the only way he could neutralize the advantage the Americans would have in manpower. Raghib, his head contorted in a painful, twisted position, spoke cautiously.
I will find her. I promise you, Rafik.
Slowly, Aziz backed away, letting his rifle fall to his side, considering whether it was worth looking for the woman. He grabbed the pile of clothes on the floor. Hassan's pistol was still in its holster, and his rifle was on top of the dresser on the other side of the room. The bloody knife was on the floor near the clothes, so the woman was unarmed. Sideways, Aziz looked at Raghib and asked,
"Was this the same woman Abu Hassan had me pull out of line this morning?"
Raghib nodded his head vigorously.
"Yes, it is the same woman."
Aziz scoffed and looked at Benghazi, who was standing closer to the door.
"I know this woman. I met her when I arrived for my meeting with that fat pig, Russ Piper."
In typical mute form, Benghazi said nothing. Aziz nodded as things started to make a little more sense. He remembered Russ Piper telling him about the woman's family.
"The woman's father is a Chicago police officer."
Aziz looked down at the dead body before him.
"That helps explain this."
When Aziz was done looking at the body, he bent down and grabbed the pile of clothes. From them, he took the pistol and the radio, then walked over to the dresser and grabbed the extra assault rifle. Aziz turned and tossed the rifle across the room at Raghib. With his own rifle in one hand, Raghib caught the other rifle with his free hand.
"Do you want me to find the girl?"
Aziz thought about it for a second and then said,
"No, she can do us no harm. All of the exits are wired. Chances are she'll set off one of the bombs and kill herself."
Benghazi cleared his throat and got Aziz's attention. Aziz looked at his second and said,
"Yes."
"I think at the very least we should do a sweep of this floor and the third."
Benghazi paused.
"It shouldn't take more than 20 minutes.
Aziz thought about it for a moment and replied,
"All right, but let's do it quickly."
As they prepared to leave, Raghib pointed to their dead comrade on the floor and asked,
"What do you want me to do with Hassan?"
Without looking back, Aziz said,
"Leave him there and let this stupid fool rot."
Chapter 26. Back at Langley, a lively discussion was underway. General Campbell wanted to broaden their vague mandate by sending two more people through the ventilation shaft. His reason was sound. They knew Aziz had brought a large amount of explosives into the White House, and they now had evidence that Aziz had strategically deployed the devices. Before any type of an assault could take place, those devices would have to be defeated, or at the very least, circumvented. To do that, they needed more information, and that meant getting someone with technical expertise into the White House. General Campbell and Irene Kennedy had again resumed their huddle with their respective bosses. Campbell stated confidently,
"Six has the people and the equipment in place, and no one knows explosives better than they do. One call to Lieutenant Commander Harris, and we can have them in the shaft in under 5 minutes."
"I'd prefer to have Iron Man look around a little more," Stansfield said.
Campbell sighed.
"I'm not sure we shouldn't have let Iron Man take them out a couple of minutes ago."
Stansfield raised an eyebrow.
"It was a very risky play for so early in the game."
"Yeah, but one that might have been worth it. And if we get it again, I'd like to be in a position to increase the odds."
"So," Flood leaned forward, placing an arm on the table, "you want to move these people in immediately?"
"Yes."
Campbell looked at his watch.
"It's almost 0100. The sun's going to be up in 5 hours. The sooner we get a clearer picture of what we're up against, the sooner we can end this thing. Plus, like all of our special forces personnel, these demo experts are cross-trained. You put two SEALs on Iron Man's flanks and..."
Campbell nodded confidently.
"The next time we get a chance to take out Aziz, we're not going to miss."
Stansfield cautioned,
"Right now we have three armed terrorists moving about the mansion in a very surly mood.
It might be wise to let them cool down before we start.
I agree, replied Campbell. We just heard them say they're going to check the second and third floors, which should take about 20 minutes. Even if we get our people moving in under 10, it'll be close to a half hour before they make it in. And besides, they're coming into the third basement, not the second floor.
What about Mitch? Asked Kennedy.